Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 8th of September. The 70th anniversary of the day Nazi bombs dropped on London, starting the Blitz that rocked English cities, was marked in England yesterday. The Blitz started at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, and it continued hitting many towns and cities across the country, beginning with the bombing of London for 76 consecutive nights. By the end of May 1941, over 43,000 civilians, half of them in London, had been killed by bombing, and more than a million houses were destroyed or damaged in London alone. As a result of the resolve of the English citizens and the reporting of American journalists, including the wonderful Edward R. Murrow, I think it swayed U.S. opinion about becoming involved in this war, which Roosevelt thought was inevitable. And we are marking today the 70th anniversary of the Blitz, how the English people went through this horrendous bombing that took place day after day after day, and how it was reported. We have a great guest with us, Lynn Olson. If you haven't read this book, we've highly recommended it. It is the author of Citizens of London, and it's an accolade to the few far-sighted Americans who became citizens of London at a time when their leaders were still beset by doubt about this faraway war. They included Averell Harriman, John Wynant, and also Edward R. Murrow, who was a reporter for CBS. And this is how he described the Blitz.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance, one single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue. Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are, just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the porthole.
Lynn Olson is our guest this hour. Her book is Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. She's also author of Troublesome Young Men, The Rebels Who Brought Churchill to Power and Helped Save England. And she is our guest this hour as we mark the 70th anniversary of the London Blitz. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Lynn, thanks so much for joining us again.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. Let's start with Edward R. Murrow and that incredibly moving reporting that he gave, the radio reports that came to the United States, and probably as much as anybody else, he helped sway American opinion here. It was, and you write about him extensively in your book, he described this, and we were hearing it on the radio in the United States, which must have been quite a powerful thing for those listening here.
Oh, it really was. I mean, you know, this is, radio news had just really begun. And to hear someone who was actually, under a bombing attack at the time describe in such an incredibly compelling way, as Murrow did, it was really quite extraordinary. I mean, you know, literally in a year, he became perhaps the most influential journalist in America because of his reporting from London.
Mm-hmm. And probably the most influential journalist who has ever reported.
Well, you know, I'm not sure about that, but I think he certainly was in terms of World War II. As you said, in my opinion and the opinion of many historians, his reporting helped sway public opinion toward getting involved and helping the British and eventually getting involved in the war.
Mm-hmm. He had great admiration, as did the others who you talk about in your book, for the endurance, the resolve of the British.
Oh, absolutely. all the reporters who were there, there were a fair number of American reporters reporting from London at the time, were just awestruck by the courage and the resolution. And you know, and in fact, the kind of endurance of the British, how they would be bombed, as you said, every night for several months, not knowing when they went into the shelter or, you know, wherever they took refuge, whether they were going to be alive the next morning, and then getting up and going to work. You know, it was just extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what the thoughts were on the part of Roosevelt prior to the Blitz and people in the United States. Were we still quite isolationist in our thoughts?
The country was still isolationist. I mean, there was a growing feeling in the country that we were probably going to have to do something to help the British. But we certainly didn't want to get involved in the war ourselves. But there was still a fair amount of feeling in the government and among people at large that Britain probably wasn't going to survive. I mean, that Britain was the last country standing in Europe against Hitler. And there was great fear that Hitler was going to invade England, which had very little money or arms at the time, and that would be the end of, basically the end of Europe. But the stick-to-itiveness of the British, I mean, their resolve and their courage during the Blitz, as reported by journalists like Murrow, really made the American people and many in the government feel that, hey, maybe, in fact, Britain would survive, and maybe, in fact, we should support her far more than we were doing at that time.
Mm-hmm. So was this the beginning of Lend-Lease? Did the Blitz precipitate that, or was that in the works before?
No, it came before, and I think the reaction, the astonishing reaction of the British of holding firm, of holding fast, helped Lend-Lease along. Lend-Lease wasn't really passed until early 1941. And Roosevelt first had the idea for it in late 1940, and that was, well after the Blitz had begun.
And tell me how ill-prepared the British were. What did they have in their reserve? Did they have much of an air force? Did they have many planes?
They had... Remember, the Blitz actually followed, the fall of France by 2 or 3 months. And it followed Dunkirk, where, hundreds of thousands of British soldiers were rescued from France, but virtually all their arms were left behind. So the British cupboard, in terms of military equipment and hardware, was fairly bare. They did have one of the areas in which they were pretty well prepared was in fighter planes, and they lost a huge number of them in the fighting over France, but they still retained hundreds, if not thousands, of them. The fighter planes were responsible for Britain's victory in the Battle of Britain, which occurred pretty much simultaneously with the Blitz. Mm-hmm. So if it hadn't been for those young British pilots, who knows what would have happened, but they, in fact, held on.
Mm-hmm. And the Germans must have thought they had absolutely nothing.
The Germans thought that the British were on their last legs, and America at that time certainly was not providing very much material at all to the British. I think Hitler thought that he was going to be able to easily win over them.
And there was at some point thoughts of a land invasion of Britain, but they couldn't do it after a certain period of time because the weather would have been too bad. Fill us in on that.
Hitler was considering an invasion of England, but in order to do that, he had to make sure that the Royal Air Force was defeated. In other words, invading over the English Channel has always been one of the most difficult propositions that any foe of Britain has faced. So in order to be able to do that, he had to get rid of the RAF. And he tried to do it in the Battle of Britain and did not succeed. And after that, even though the British were worried about an invasion for another year or so, it was not in the cards. He really had to do it in the fall of 1940, and he didn't.
We were talking about this, my husband and I, last night, and he's a big World War II buff, but just putting it in the context of our own home, sitting in the living room, imagining what it would be like if there were bombers, lots of bombers, hitting the city night after night after night after night for 76 nights.
Then, I know, it really is almost unimaginable.
Yes.
You know, how can you go through that? Once a week or once a month, but to do it night after night as a regular occurrence and to keep on, you know, trying to live a regular life, it's just mind-boggling.
When you said get up and go to work the next day, what?
You think, I know. They did. Even, you know, there's a wonderful anecdote I tell in my book about an American reporter who was staying at one of the posh London hotels during this period. And after a horrific bombing raid the night before, he was stunned to find that his maid and the maitre d' in the restaurant, etc., were at work, even though in a couple of cases their houses had been bombed and destroyed. They just got up and they just went back to work. And that's the extraordinary characteristic of the British people at that time. They weren't going to let the Germans defeat them.
And so if you're hearing that news from Edward R. Murrow or others and you're sitting in your living room somewhere in America, a lot of people have to say, we just can't let them down.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. Murrow particularly, but the other reporters did as well, but Murrow particularly was able to put the American people in the shoes of the British people. He was a genius at describing in very small detail what life was like and what the danger was like. So listening to him on the radio, you could envision yourself on the streets of London and feeling what the British were feeling. It was an extraordinary ability he had, and it really had a great impact.
And the others who are in your book, tell me about them a little bit and their relationship, very close relationship with Winston Churchill, and how that may, in no small measure, have cemented a closer relationship with the United States.
Well, the three men, as you said earlier, were Murrow, John Gilbert Wynant, who was the American ambassador to Britain, and Averell Harriman, who was in charge of Lend-Lease. All three of them became very close to Churchill, Wynant and Harriman particularly. And they were really instrumental in trying to persuade the American government that they had to do more, that if Britain went down, then the U.S. would face a catastrophe as well. And they were very, they succeeded in doing that.
Mm-hmm. How close are we to the time period when Ambassador Joseph Kennedy was relieved of his duties?
Well, actually, we're talking about the same period. Joe Kennedy, who was Wynant's predecessor, stayed in England until the height of the Blitz, and he did not distinguish himself. He would, he would be in London during the day, but he would leave London at night before the German bombers arrived to take refuge at an estate near Windsor Castle, which was well outside London and was not being bombed. So this obviously did not go over very well with the British people. But he left. He left at the end of October 1940 and did not return. He went back basically to tell Roosevelt that he shouldn't help the British. Kennedy was very appeasement-minded, and Roosevelt at that point, Kennedy was going to resign anyway, but Roosevelt gladly accepted his resignation.
And what about the Germans? How did they respond to this phenomenal resolve?
They weren't expecting it. I think they kept thinking that they were going to win still. But as it went on, it was clear the British were not going to give up. And at that point, once Hitler realized that an invasion of Britain was not possible at that particular time, then he made the fatal mistake of deciding to invade the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. which he did the following year. And once that decision was made, then the bombing stopped. The bombing of London and the rest of Britain stopped. That was in early 1941, about March, April 1941. Then the pressure was off the British at that point to some extent. They were not bombed again until late in the war.
I'm sure that you've asked yourself the question, and I wonder how you answer it. What if they had won?
I do ask that question a lot. It would be horrific. I mean, the world would be totally changed. I don't think that many Americans still realize how important the survival of Britain was at that particular time. It was the last bastion of freedom and democracy in Europe, but it was also the only military power still standing against Hitler, as diminished as that power was. And if England had gone down, we would have been in terrible straits. I mean, it's not just the fact of England. It's the fact that we would no longer have been protected by the British fleet, which was extraordinarily important in our own defense. And so we would have been faced with a horrendous problem. And God only knows what would have happened.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls. Lynn Olson, we're delighted to have her with us. She has written a wonderful book. We interviewed her when the book came out, and we're talking to her today about the 70th anniversary of the Blitz, which started yesterday afternoon. Her book is Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour, including she has some remarkable writing about the Blitz and how Murrow responded to that, and it got us listening to some of his reporting yesterday, which truly is extraordinary. We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send us an email, that would be great. And it's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I was asked last week whether I was aware of some uneasiness which, it was said, existed in the country on account of the gravity, as it was described, of the war situation. So I thought it would be a good thing to go and see for myself what this uneasiness amounted to. And I went to some of our great cities and seaports, which have been most heavily bombed, and to some of the places where the poorest people have got it worst. I've come back to the front, by which I mean the streets and wharves of London or Liverpool, Manchester, Cardiff, Swansea, or Bristol. It's like going out of a hothouse onto the bridge of a fighting ship. It is a tonic which I should recommend any who are suffering, and where the ordeal of the men, women, and children has been most severe, that I found their morale most high and splendid. Indeed, I felt encompassed by an exaltation of spirit in the mankind and its troubles above the level of material facts, into that joyous serenity we think belongs to a better world than this.
Prime Minister Winston Churchill, would you like to comment, Lynn, on his survey of the damage after the Blitz?
Well, I'd like to comment on the eloquence of his words.
Oh, my, yes. Yes.
When you listen to Winston Churchill, you realize what political speech can be all about, and, mm-hmm. and there's nobody been like him since then. He had made that comment right after he returned from a long tour of British cities other than London that had been bombed very badly, including Bristol and Swansea and others. And he talked in that clip that you played about the incredible spirit that he had found, and that was true. He, along with Winant, actually Gil Winant, the U.S. ambassador, walked the streets of those cities, and they had been bombed just the night before, and you know, people had lost their homes, many hundreds of people had been killed, and yet you know, they crowded around the prime minister and said, you know, give him hell, Winnie, and we're never going to give up, and he was so moved by their resilience and by their courage that he actually cried on the way home. And said, you know, how can I ever live up to them? And so he that emotion and that feeling that you heard in that clip was not pretended. It was not feigned. I mean, it was very real.
Let's go to phone calls for you. We start with Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
Great show. God, I love hearing that voice. God, you know, if we could have people like that running this today, I don't think we'd be in the mess we find ourselves. My question, though, is this. I think I remember reading at some point that, in an odd sort of way, Hitler actually very much admired the Brits and really thought that, you know, the way they had established their empire and handled themselves was something that the Germans could learn a lot from, and that, in fact, he was convinced, one of the reasons that he let Goering talk him into going with an air campaign rather than an invasion, was that he thought that he could bomb England enough that the British would, from his perspective, come to their senses and realize that they had a lot more in common than they did in opposition, and that he could get them to sue for peace, and then they could concentrate on getting rid of what he determined as the real evil in the world, which was Stalin's Soviet Union. Can you comment on that? Is that in fact accurate?
I think you're right in virtually everything you said. Hitler did admire England, he did not really want to have to go to war against England. He never did. He tried very hard to get England to basically give in peacefully right from the very beginning. And throughout the early years of the war, there was great reluctance on his part to go the final step. For example, at Dunkirk, he ordered German tanks to stop short of really annihilating the British Army. And one reason that historians have offered for that reluctance is the fact that he really did not want to defeat England. Whether or not he decided to start with an air campaign because of his reluctance his desire to come to terms with England, I'm not sure. He certainly thought, in order to be successful in terms of an invasion, that there had to be air dominance, and that was definitely true. And he didn't secure that air dominance. But there was certainly, as you pointed out, certainly a very strong and lingering admiration for what the British had done.
Anything else, Scott?
No, I share that admiration, by the way. And I think no one can ever say enough about those pilots in their rickety little airplanes that went up and fought against that onslaught. And if you ever, I'm sure you must cover this, but when you read about, like, they would just be dead tired on their feet going back up over and over and over again, just about,
you're absolutely right. It's just extraordinary, their courage and what they did. I couldn't agree with you more.
Moving. Thanks again.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for your call. Bob in Onalaska. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I was just going to say that my mother was in Wales, and she told me about during the war. And the main thing that she always told me was that they listened to those speeches from Churchill, and it just gave them so much courage to keep going. And then she also said about the incendiary bombs, where they used to have to go up on the roof and take them off so they wouldn't get fire going. And then the other thing she said was that they took refuge in subways, and everybody would sing, and, you know, they kept their spirits up.
It was really an extraordinary time to be there. You know, it was incredibly scary. It was very, very frightening. But a lot of people have talked about how it was the best time in their whole life. I mean, that there was a great feeling of being alive. You know, of saving the world. And in fact, in many ways, they were doing that.
Yes, they were, weren't they?
Absolutely.
It's not an overstatement. They were saving the world.
Absolutely.
You write about some of the reporters. Was it Eric Severide or someone else who would leave, but they just couldn't stand to be away, perhaps because they missed that sense of saving the world? They'd be gone for a respite, and they just had to come back.
Yeah, well, that was true of many American reporters. He actually, Eric Sevrite actually left for good and was and did an amazingly eloquent broadcast about that and about his love and admiration for the British. But other reporters did go away for, you know, like just for R&R, for a weekend or for a week to Ireland, which was neutral at the time, or to some other neutral country, even back to the United States, which was, of course, still neutral, and feeling kind of a sense of relief, but almost immediately a sense of guilt for being there and a sense that this was not the real world, that the real world was back in London, and then they longed to get back to the firing line.
Mm-hmm. Kelly is next in Manitowoc. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen? I just wanted to make a comment. My mom was 10 in Bradford, Yorkshire, which is more the industrial north of England. And she tells so many stories to grandkids, not to myself. I would have loved to have heard them growing up. But what she talks about is the air raid shelters that they built out back in the fields where so many families could go to each air raid shelter. So you had to know which shelter to go to, and they would hold these drills. And then because of the bombing at night, the whole town would have to be lit up. All the streets were bright. So when she had to go to school in the morning, a person would come around and knock on all the windows with a broomstick. They called them knocker-uppers, and they would wake the kids up so they could go to school, because basically it was like 24 hours while these air raids were going on. And it was so neat that you hear her talk about her brother who was in the Royal Air Force, and just the stories that they can come back. She's 80 right now. She'll be 81 in April. And she just has so much. She didn't immigrate to the U.S. till the 60s. So it's kind of cool.
Oh, I'm glad you're getting those stories. Get certainly as many of them as you can. Can you talk a little bit more about the air raid shelter system?
Well, it differed all over England. In London, first I ought to make clear that the British government was not really ready for this at all. They had not built really good air raid shelters. In fact, most of the air raid shelters in the beginning were really makeshift. I mean, one of the previous callers referred to the subway, to the tube in London, which are their subways. And the subways were not supposed to be air raid shelters. There was no plan to make them, but because there were not enough, in fact, there were almost no deep, really deep air raid shelters, the British public just took over the subway stations, which were obviously deep underground, and made them air raid shelters. So many of them, in fact, most of them, were really makeshift, and they were really horrible in terms of their conditions, sanitary conditions, etc. And it wasn't until basically the public took it into their own hands to improve them and to demand from the Churchill government that money be paid, spent to make them better, were they in fact improved? So it was really the pressure of the British public, of Londoners, but in residents all over the country, that in fact they were improved.
There was a hit on CBS News, wasn't there, and Murrow lost a couple colleagues?
There was a hit on the bombing of the BBC.
BBC,
yeah.
Where they were broadcasting.
The BBC building in London was one of the main targets of the German bombers, not surprisingly. And the American reporters broadcast from the BBC. It suffered a direct hit during the Blitz, and I think seven BBC staffers, including some good friends of Murrow's, were killed. Murrow himself, or the CBS itself, lost several offices. Its offices were not in the BBC. They were located, in streets right around the BBC, but CBS lost three offices during that period, too, so they had to keep, thankfully no CBS staffers were killed, but they had to keep relocating because they kept getting bombed out.
Here's an email from Frank in Green Bay. Lynn, please comment that it was not just London in the Blitz. Most British cities suffered. I believe the Scottish shipbuilding town of Clydebank suffered most. Only four houses out of tens of thousands surviving the war undamaged.
Yeah, we have talked about other cities, but definitely should emphasize that it was certainly not just London. Most of the major industrial towns, most of the major ports were severely bombed, and in fact had it in many ways much worse than London, because London is a huge city, and even though huge parts of it were bombed and suffered tremendous damage, there were many parts that were not bombed. And London had much more going for it. It had a very developed services, etc., because it was the capital. But many of these other cities did not have the kinds of services like firefighting, etc., that London did. So they were severely damaged.
We go next to Kenneth in Milton. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I just wanted to make a clearer picture of what was actually happening here in the United States. I mean, in 1935, a law was passed by Congress which said that no military aid would go, or no federal dollars would be spent on military aid to combatants, you know, because there was a discussion about what was going on in Europe during that time. And this was accomplished by the America Firsters, who, you know, said no United Nations, no involvement with the rest of the world. The person, one of the persons most involved was George W. Bush's great-grandfather.
All right, let's get a response. Lynn?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. There was one of the reasons why Roosevelt was so hesitant about going to the aid of the British and of getting involved more in the war is because of the strength of the isolationists that you mentioned. And America First Committee was organized in 1940, and it was the strongest organization in the isolationist cause, and they were very potent and very powerful. You know, a lot of American public opinion, while it more and more it favored going to the aid of Britain, of helping Britain survive, still did not want the U.S. to get into the war, really, until Pearl Harbor. So Roosevelt was faced with a very, very strong opposition, not only within the Congress, but, you know, in the American public at large.
We go next to Jerry in Madison. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Kathleen. I was wondering if your guest could speak to the British royal family. They had German roots, and they had, in fact, changed their name from the original German, which I don't recall what that was, to Windsor, so as to make them appear less pro-German. And it's also been suggested that the Duke of Windsor abdicated the throne, or was forced to abdicate the throne, I should say, because of his strong pro-Nazi sentiments, as opposed to the purported reason that he wanted to keep his American bride. Any comment on that?
To go to your point about the Duke of Windsor, he certainly was pro-German, but I don't believe that. I mean, he abdicated the throne, I believe, because he was not allowed. If he stayed on as king, he would not have been allowed to marry the woman he wanted to marry. But there's no question that his pro-Germanness caused a great amount of angst within the British government. The rest of the royal family, in the years running up to World War II, they, like many of the upper crust of Britain, were pro-German. There's no question about it. But when the war began, there's also no question that the royal family, prominently including King George, was incredibly it was certainly not pro-German. I mean, they were incredibly patriotic. In fact, the royal family refused to leave London. Many politicians wanted the king and queen and their daughters to get out of London so that they would, you know, to remove them from the threat of bombing, and they absolutely refused. I think Queen Elizabeth was quoted as saying, "I couldn't look Londoners in the face if I did that," and they stayed. And Buckingham Palace was indeed bombed. They narrowly escaped being killed themselves, but they refused to go.
Hmm. Thanks, Jerry, for the call. Here's an email that's come in from Christopher. Could you comment, Lynn, on the British development of radar and how it changed the course of the Battle of Britain?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that, but the British did their discovery, their development of radar, really in the nick of time, did have a huge impact on the Battle of Britain. I said earlier that the British did have a fair number of fighter planes left, which they did, but not as many as the Germans. I mean, you know, the German Luftwaffe was stronger than the RAF at the beginning of the Battle of Britain. But because of radar, because the British knew when the Germans were coming over the Channel on a bombing raid, they were able to pinpoint. They were able to send up the fighter planes they had to meet these bombers. And so, you know, they had an advance warning, and which helped them immensely mm-hmm. in the fight.
Was there, considering the fact that the Blitz was sustained firepower on non-military targets, was there outrage about that? Was that something, the extent of this, that was new in warfare?
That sustained attack was new, but certainly the dictators, Hitler and Mussolini, had already showed that they didn't care about civilian populations. I mean, they did that in Spain when Germany and Italy joined forces with Franco against the government of Spain in the Spanish Civil War. German bombers bombed Spanish civilians. When the war began, when Hitler's blitzkrieg of Western Europe began, he firebombed Rotterdam. So there were a number of cities throughout Europe that had already experienced this kind of attack before London. London, it was the most sustained attack, for 3 months every night. So it was a much more greater in size, but it had gone on before.
We're continuing our phone calls and conversations. Yesterday marked the 70th anniversary of the London Blitz, and we're talking about that with the author of a very, very good book. We've talked to her about the book before, and she's commenting for us today on the anniversary of the Blitz. Her book is Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The other day, President Roosevelt gave his opponent in the late presidential election a letter of introduction to me. And in it he wrote out a verse in his own handwriting from Longfellow, which he said applies to you people as it does to us. Here is the verse. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice-chosen head of a nation of 130 million? Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools and we will finish the job.
Prime Minister Winston Churchill in February of 1941. I feel like I just want to listen to Winston Churchill for the rest of the day. Don't you?
He is totally addictive.
Oh, my gosh. The way he read, sail on, O ship of state. Oh, my goodness. Woo. Let's go to Carolyn from Elm Grove. Hi, Carolyn.
Good morning. Fascinating show. I just wanted to share with you a couple of comments. One is that my father was a B-17 bomber pilot stationed just north of London during the war. And in 2003, he had an opportunity to go back and visit. And in the process of visiting, in this community, people were always so ecstatic to see these guys come back and visit. And they would welcome them with open arms, and they would tell stories and invite them into their homes and invite them into the pubs and have wonderful little dinners. And in the process, the elders of the community who had been very much a part of what was going on during that time frame would gather around and they would talk. And one of the stories that we just found so incredibly fascinating was that during World War II, as the city was being blitzed, they took the rubble, wallpaper on the back of the plaster and all, and took it out to these little communities where they had these airfields and built the runways out of the rubble. And one of the things, and of course, we always thought that there was such poetic justice to that, the very fields that the very rubble that they took up on would many times put these planes into flight and carry them over to armament plants in Germany, et cetera, and so on. The other point is that on the weekends or when they would have a leave, many of the pilots and maintenance folk would go into London for a night, and there would be shows, and my dad was very much into the playwrights and opera, and they would go in and they would listen, and it was just, you know, things continued on. Life went on, and at any rate, it was probably one of the times in his life that he probably has just, tremendous memories, fondness. There's a wonderful historical 8th Air Force Historical Society in Milwaukee that, does a lot, has a lot of wonderful programming that's dedicated to this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Those moments obviously would be deeply remembered and probably, I don't know if you could say they're high points, but the most memorable parts of many people's lives.
Oh, absolutely. And there was a closeness, between American soldiers and pilots that came over and the British people. Initially, there was a lot of tension too, because you had, more than a million young American men arriving on British soil in this tiny country, and so there were a lot of problems. But there was also a tremendous amount of deep feeling between the two groups that your caller referred to. I mean, it was an extraordinary experience, and for many people, as you said, Kathleen, it really was the defining, for many, particularly young men, it was the defining moment of their life.
Mm-hmm. And I love your report about Murrow, who lived through the Blitz, and as we started our show, and many years later said his most prized possession was the microphone that he used to tell the world, this is London.
That's right. When he left after the war, the BBC cut the wires of that microphone and presented it to him, and it was one of the very few times he ever cried in public. He felt him, deep down, I think he felt himself more of an Englishman sometimes than an American.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Carolyn, for your call. Charles from Ingleside, Illinois. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. I apologize calling again so soon, but I wanted to tell this story. I wanted to quarrel a little bit with your speaker's description of Murrow telling us so clearly you could see the streets of London. I was a pumpman on tankers, and towards the end of the war, we went into Southampton and pumped out. But the buzz bombs and the V-bombs were flying then. But all the crew left, and I was the only one left on the ship to pump it out. And a Brit helped me do it. But when I got through, there was nobody there, so I got on the train and went from Southampton to London and got on a bus, and I rode to the end of the line and then return right back to the train station, and I didn't want to stay. But those streets were unbelievable. You couldn't tell if a store was there. The rubble had just come down into the street, and it was everywhere, and they piled it around entrances where they were running a shop, or maybe people were living, but you couldn't tell there was any normal life whatsoever. Great big tanks, water tanks, were everywhere because the water lines were broken, and they had water to put fires out with it. And just rubble, and there was nothing imaginable that livable on that particular street where the bus was trying to weave its way through the what was left. Myrtle didn't quite describe it. You'd have to be there to see it to even imagine what it would look like.
Mm. Well, I will quarrel with you a little bit. If you listen to a number of his broadcasts, I mean, I think you really got a flavor of that. He really did describe very, very vividly what you're talking about. I mean, you went there toward the end of the war, and it was much worse because, as you said, the V-bomb, in 1944 and 1945, the Brits were hit again with a huge bombing attack by rockets and missiles this time. By that time, it was infinitely, the damage was infinitely greater than it was during the Blitz.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Charles, so much for your call. And we go next to James from Monona. Hi, James.
Hi. Are you? I have a question. Thomas Jefferson, in the famous quote, said that religion was responsible for the death of millions of innocent people throughout all of history. I'm a minister, by the way, in background. And what is widely known among scholars is the point that Jefferson made, but it's not generally known among the general population, and that is that during the Crusades, the Crusaders went into Constantinople and wiped out over 30,000 Eastern Orthodox people because they were considered heretics at that time because they had separated from the Catholic Church. And likewise, they murdered Jews in 700 cities on their way to the Crusades to Jerusalem. These are facts that scholars know, but the general population does not. One of many books on the subject that's in a popular context is The Sword of Constantine by John Carroll, who was the chaplain at Boston College at one time, and a well-known writer, novelist, and head of one of the religion writers for the Boston Globe. But the point of it is, indiscriminate bombing did not begin with Hitler and Mussolini. Where it began, I don't know, but there's a long history of centuries of the church being indiscriminately responsible for the death of millions of innocent people. So much so that the command was not only kill them with the sword, but put the sword in the belly of the pregnant women, so it would kill the child.
Lynn.
Yeah, that is true, but, you know, we're focusing right now on Hitler and Mussolini. You're absolutely right. I mean, the death of civilians has you know, been commonplace throughout the centuries, and, you know, churches have been responsible, but religion has been responsible. But in this case, you know, it was all of that is true. But the danger posed by Hitler and Nazism, I think, was really quite honestly the biggest threat of all.
Lynn,
up to that point,
what do you think of the? A lot was made of this footage, this color footage that was found, and it was all over television in marking the 70th anniversary. Was that a big finding?
I don't know if it was a big finding. I took a look at it yesterday on the internet, some of it, and I must say, seeing the Blitz in color brings an immediacy to it that
mm-hmm.
you don't get in black and white footage. I mean, there's about 30 seconds, a minute worth of rescue workers taking people out of a bombed out building, and seeing these people on stretchers, some of them who are dead, it really brings it home to you in a way that it, you know, you don't get otherwise. It's really quite affecting and really quite moving stuff.
Right. Thank you ever so much for being with us. I always highly recommend your book. I just think it's so good.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah,
I really appreciate
it. It is. It's just so good, and it's so creatively done and wonderful stories. And I just love our audience. It's so great to do a show. It makes you love public radio and have
Absolutely.
All the phone lines going.
Absolutely.
And
they're the best part of the show.
Aren't they? And the tons of emails and people involved in this issue. It's good. Thank you, Lynn.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me on.
Yeah, a great pleasure. Our guest, Lynn Olson, her book is Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Chrissy Pease for production and for getting sound for us, and thanks, everybody, for caring about this subject and knowing a lot about it. You're all right. We'll return following the news.